From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. While they don't control the levers of power in Salem, Oregon Republicans are busy working to introduce and pass legislation they hope will garner bipartisan support. One such bill is aimed at strengthening sex offender laws and tightening up the sex offender registry. Today on the show, the leader of the Republicans in the House, Christine Drazen, will tell you about the bill and what she hopes will become legislation that both parties support. In the second half, you'll hear from an Oregon psychiatrist who works within the federal government, and she's helping guide other federal workers through the tumult and stress of massive layoffs and mass confusion. Some of her advice, surprisingly enough, comes from experts who say in order to survive this ordeal, government workers should think like hostages. That's next on Oregon on the Record. The Republicans in the Oregon House have introduced a bill that would strengthen sex offender laws in the state. They say that the system by which offenders are placed on the registry is broken, and today on the show, Minority Leader Christine Drazen joins us to talk about their goal. House Republican Leader Christine Drazen of Canby, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I know that you have introduced legislation to strengthen sex offender laws. Why don't you tell us what's in this bill?
You know, we have been really derelict when it comes to ensuring that the risk assessments that are done for sexual predators and offenders, that they are appropriately flagged for the level of risk to the community. So my legislation puts victims back at the center of that conversation. Okay. And ensures that victims can appeal the level that sex offenders have been placed at. Level one is the lowest level, and level three is the level where the public has access to that information. And sometimes the victims of these offenses, after someone is about ready, you know, to be paroled, they feel very strongly that the designation won't keep the community safe, that someone's been artificially put at level one when they should have more supervision than that, or that the public should be able to know or and be notified if they come into the community. And it's only level three that has that kind of level of transparency and that level of notification. And so victims have come forward and made it clear that the parole board itself is not doing a good enough job informing the public and making sure that victims are involved in that process. So like someone that's going to be released, they have plenty of opportunities to be able to appeal. But for the victims, they don't have the opportunity right now under current Oregon law to appeal that particular designation. And so they'd like to see that changed. And they'd like to be a part of the process moving forward, that they have a task force that makes sure that when they're collecting other information and they're making changes to this risk assessment level, that victims are included in those conversations.
Okay, and is it that sometimes in you know, one jurisdiction or maybe out of state, a sex offender might be adjudicated at one level, like that level one. And then when they move to Oregon or move to a different jurisdiction, it kind of gets confusing. And this would help sort of, you know, kind of uniformly adjudicate the right level for them.
So that has been part of the challenge. Okay. Is that when people are in another state, there was a story today when I was having a conversation with some women that came forward to testify here in the Capitol building that spoke out on this issue. They had said that there was a sex offender that was a level three in another state that came to Oregon. And when they came to Oregon, Oregon did not immediately just adopt that level for that sex offender, but put them into a process to reassign them and review them. And in the meantime, this person is coaching, you know, some youth sports and coming in daily regular contact with youth, and the community is then put at risk. The kids are put at risk. And so the state is failing its duty to ensure that the most dangerous folks that are out in our neighborhoods, that there is a way for people to ensure that when they do a background check, that it's reliable, that when notifications go out, that it's going out to the community so that they're kept safe. But really, if you don't actually go through this population and assign them these risk levels, the community's in the dark. We have 34,000 registered sex offenders in our state, but less than 2,000 are posted currently on our sex offender registry website itself. So that means out of 34,000 folks, the public can only know today about 2,000 of those individuals. So we have a huge backlog. And then we also have a process that victims feel like is quite broken when it comes to classifying these offenders when they come out of prison.
Okay. Do you think you're going to get bipartisan support for this legislation?
Gosh, I want to. This should not be a partisan issue. These lives are really, really harmed by these kinds of crimes. I've heard victims talk about it like they are the walking dead. Like something was taken from them, like their soul was taken from them when they are violated in this way. This is the kind of crime that should be prevented, and after it's occurred, these folks need to be held accountable. And that should never be partisan. That should never be partisan. So I really do hope that my colleagues across the aisle will join me in reevaluating some of these gaps in protecting our communities.
Okay. Does this bill, this legislation, does it also sort of fit into, you know, the direction that your caucus wants to try and take this legislative session in terms of law enforcement, in terms of tightening up gaps? Does this kind of fit in with what you're trying to accomplish in this 2025 session?
Yeah, Republicans in the House are committed to ensuring that that our state really functions well in support of Oregonians themselves. In this category of public safety, we know that there's a lot of work to be done. And we know that the same is true for our roads and our schools. We know that the same is true when it comes for taxes and affordability. So we have an agenda this session that is really focused on lowering the cost of living here in the areas we can control, which mm-hmm. is taxation, whether or not that's property taxes or whether or not that's income taxes, taxes on tips, estate taxes. All of those things are within our control here in the state capitol. But also issues like this, where we have vulnerable populations that have been harmed, and instead of protecting them long term and putting their voices and their concerns at the center of this conversation, they have been set to the side. The governor has legislation that was up in committee today that, instead of fixing this sex offender registry challenge that we have, she would instead just put everybody at a level where they would not even need to be registered. And that doesn't keep anybody safer. That just solves an administrative challenge that they haven't been able to overcome. That's not the answer. That's not leadership. And that doesn't serve our state. And so I don't think that this should be partisan. I hope that the governor and I hope that my colleagues across the aisle reconsider that approach. But for Republicans, we are listening to Oregonians that are feeling frustrated about the direction our state is going. They feel strongly our state is going in the wrong direction. Well, we can fix that. We can change course. We can recognize these challenges that we have, and we can work together to begin to really make a difference in the lives of Oregonians.
Representative, last time you and I talked, we did a preview of the legislative session. So I wanted to take this opportunity. Sort of the last question is to ask you, sort of from your perspective in the Republican caucus, how are things going? What are some of the positives and what are some of the negatives that have happened in the weeks that you've been in session?
Yeah, thank you for that question. We have in particular around issues like our natural resource-based issues for wildfire response. We're working really hard to repeal what are known as the wildfire maps in the state of Oregon, where they took every tax lot across the state and then they assigned it a risk level. And when they did that, for a lot of folks that were assigned a high risk level, those folks suddenly found that they couldn't sell their home, or they couldn't get insurance, they suddenly had requirements and mandates for what kind of vegetation they can have and where trees can be on their property and what kind of roofing they can use. And a lot of folks, seniors, those on fixed income, lower income Oregonians, they couldn't afford it if they wanted to. And for the rest of the population, they felt really strongly that the state shouldn't be mandating those kinds of things on them and their households when they knew, when they know best what the, what it's like to live in the communities that they live in. So we are working in a bipartisan way moving forward to repeal those maps. I think that there's interest across the aisle to get that done. We need to finish that job. We need them to work with us to get, to get that legislation. It's still being drafted. We're working to make sure that as it gets drafted, that it's responsive to everybody's concerns. So we need to fix that. That's a big problem. It's got to be fixed. I think that's a positive that we are continuing to work together towards that. But, you know, on the other side of that, there's some hard things that are under discussion right now. There's really an assault on Oregon's farmers happening in the state legislature right now, whether or not it's the tools that they need to farm, or whether or not it's the cost that they incur. We have just an approach to farming right now that just is not supporting Oregon agriculture, and that's a real problem, and we're fighting against that. And we are certainly fighting hard to get our bills heard in committee to lower the cost of living for Oregonians.
She's the Republican leader in the Oregon House, Christine Drazen. Thank you so much for coming on and talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Our next guest is a psychiatrist who writes for and speaks to federal workers going through an unprecedented level of confusion and fear. We talk with her now. Dr. Jamie Lusk, who's a doctor in psychology and is a former member of the United States Marine Corps. She's based out of Portland. Thanks so much for coming on and chatting with us.
Yeah, thank you for letting me meet you here.
Yeah. I read you do blog work for Psychology Today, and you know, it was fascinating to read, especially given what's happening with so many people in the federal workforce, and of course, I would never want to equate losing one's job with the trauma of war, but it was interesting. You know, your blog, and certainly through your experience, you know, the title of the blog is In Tumultuous Times, Think Like a Hostage, which sounds very, very dark and stark, but at the same time, you have some great advice for people going through this incredibly confusing times. Why don't you give us sort of the 30,000-foot view of the blog post that you wrote and the advice that you're giving?
Well, you're right that this isn't war and certainly not a hostage situation. And yet the fear that federal employees are feeling is real. And there's such a sense of lack of agency and panic that I really wanted to speak to that. I have close friends. I'm in the federal workforce. Mm-hmm. I have close friends who are feeling such fear that they aren't able to engage fully with the responsibilities of their job. And that's really sad because our job is critical. Most of my friends serve veterans, and those veterans are also experiencing fear. Veterans are currently afraid they're going to lose services and perhaps service connection.
Again, like I said, not making the comparison to war, but certainly, and I imagine you know this better than most, you know, a lot's been written by experts such as yourself saying losing a job is really high up on the life stressors level. And I imagine, you know, this has been happening so fast. Yes, there were indicators that there was going to be a lot of changes at the federal level, but I think everybody has been sort of taken by how quickly this has happened with, you know, sometimes, you know, 24 hours notice. Is that another sort of an element of this, is that it just seems to be happening at breakneck speed?
Yes, fast and unpredictable. So our minds really, the job of our minds is to predict and control. And when we can't predict what's going to happen next, and when we don't feel a sense of control, even though it may not be a physical threat right in front of us, like an enemy or a saber-toothed tiger, our brains process that similarly. So to the extent that something is hitting us like life threat, And it's sudden and unpredictable. It's going to feel really similar in our brains to a physical threat in front of us. So, you know, what I find incredibly sad is as we have this rhetoric of meritocracy, the people who are being dismissed are not poor performers.
Sure.
So probationary employees were fired, and that doesn't mean they're on probation. It means they're new. So they could have served for a decade in another capacity in a federal agency, be one of the most competent people on the planet, and they got hired within the last year. They're a probationary employee. So these cuts and these job losses are very random, definitely not merit-based. And I think something that's true in the federal workforce is that there's a lot of trust in the hierarchy, a lot of trust in your immediate supervisor. Those supervisors have been taken out of the decision-making. So federal workers are receiving non-contextual emails that aren't coming through their chain of command and aren't contextually based and aren't based on maybe what they're experiencing in their actual job. So that's also very scary, sort of an unknown threat behind a curtain without context.
Yeah, yeah. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking to Dr. Jamie Lusk. She's a doctor in psychology who is written a blog post on Psychology Today aimed at helping federal workers who are in this very confusing and fearful time. You know, your blog is titled, you know, Think Like a Hostage, and you have these great bullet points to kind of, you know, a process. Let's go through them. And this may be the most difficult. Manage fear and despair. How do we do that?
I love this quote I came across about hope, and it said, you know, think globally, hope locally. So I think what I see around me is people deciding to kind of shrink their focus and look at what they can make immediate impact on. I've always been inspired by Admiral James Stockdale, who was the highest ranking military officer in Hanoi Hilton. And he just displayed incredible bravery, but very locally. And it was very much about creating community and inspiring the resistance and inspiring connection within his fellow prisoners of war. And that piece, hoping locally, how do we find each other? One of my colleagues who is currently at the VA texted me yesterday and said he, instead of wishing the storm away, his strategy is keeping the ship aright at sea. So I thought that was really lovely. So he's maybe thinking globally, there's a huge storm, but hoping locally, how do I keep this keel even? And how do I keep this ship right in this moment, in this moment, in this moment?
You know, another piece of advice you give, you know, the subheading is recognize and combat Stockholm syndrome. First, explain what Stockholm syndrome is and why it's important to combat against it.
Yes, when we do feel captive in a situation that we are under someone's power, it's a survival strategy to empathize with that captor, especially if we think that captor is connected to our survival. If they are beating us, if they're in charge of our paycheck, it's a survival strategy to empathize with them. And that, while that is helpful, it can lead to over empathizing and maybe even supporting the mission. So we even see this. I work a lot with sexual assault survivors. And if they were in a situation where they depended on their perpetrator, perhaps their perpetrator was in their chain of command or was a family member, then they can identify and even maybe collude with their perpetrator. And we see that often in hostage situations. An extreme example is Patty Hearst,
of course,
who ended up being kidnapped and then eventually participating in a bank robbery with her captors. But we see it on this level right now.
My last one I want to talk to you about or ask you about is it's one of the last parts of the blog where you talk about find what brings you a better space.
Well, I think it's okay to escape in some of the things that bring you joy in the moment, whether that's walking in nature or playing with your dog or connecting with your friends or daydreaming about what you're going to do when you have more resources. And I think even farther than that, there's reason to hope even when circumstances are very bad. Humans have learned to connect and find joy in the most extreme circumstances. There's some really cool research and anecdotes out of World War II where in England, the population was forced to live in tunnels and bomb shelters. And what's interesting is thefts and crimes went way down. And people could volunteer to be ambulance drivers, even from the state hospital. So people with serious mental illness were driving ambulance, and it was the healthiest they've ever been and the most sort of connected they've ever been. So these interesting, powerful communities can arise in circumstances of hardship. So I think that is a reason to genuinely hope. So I think we can hope in the alliances that are forming right now. And even within this conversation, the connections that might happen through listening to your radio, these matter. And that's a reason to hope.
Good enough. Good enough. Dr. Jamie Lusk, she's part of the federal workforce, but she also helps those in the federal workforce. We've been talking about her blog post for Psychology Today, In Tumultuous Times, Think Like a Hostage. Jamie, thank you so much for coming on and providing your advice and counsel.
Thank you for having me.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, we catch up with Eugene Mayor Karin Knudsen. She's been on the job for only a few weeks, but she and the council have already had to make difficult choices around the budget. I'm Michael Dunn, and this has been Oregon on the Record from KLCC. Thanks for listening.